Welcome to this episode of the Cyber Guy Podcast. I'm your host, retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Darren Mott. In this episode, I'll discuss the FBI's outreach program as well as cyber education and how both those things can help reduce your cyber risk, not just for you personally, but for your business as well. I'll do this with retired FBI Special Agent Kerry Straub. Kerry spent his entire FBI career in Huntsville, Alabama, and in addition to discussing the FBI outreach program, he'll talk about a few of the cases he investigated here that really could have only happened in Alabama. So first off, thanks as always for everyone listening to and downloading this podcast. It can be found on all your major podcast platforms to include Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Pandora. If you like what you hear, feel free to leave a review and tell a couple friends. My goal as always with this podcast is to help educate people as to the evolving nature of the cyber threats and help individuals and companies reduce their cyber risk. I follow cybersecurity news all the time, so I'm up on top of most of it. Not all of it, obviously. Can't keep on top of all of it, but I try to keep on top of the most important things and try to share those with you here so that you can be better educated as you go throughout your day and help reduce the risk so you do not become a cyber victim. Before I get to the interview with Kerry Straub, let me start with a couple of cybersecurity news items I found that were interesting this week. The first one is was headlined, "Ransomware is Increasing Against Schools," which really should not be a surprise as students across the country are going back to school for fall 2020 in a variety of different methodologies. Some are going into the school, some are doing remote learning, some are doing a hybrid version of that. And as a result, ransomware is targeting schools and becoming very effective at making it problematic for those schools to do online learning. The latest is a strike against a California school district that closed down remote learning for 6,000 elementary school students, according to city officials in Valencia, California. It impacted 10 different grade schools across that district. And what happened was the superintendent of the school district said that the cyber criminals struck on Sunday into Monday morning, and that he noticed something was wrong after getting consistent error messages when trying to access his Outlook and his email. And shortly afterwards, it became apparent that the district had become victimized by malware. I think as we go forward, we're going to see a lot more of this occurring, simply because school districts have tight budgets as it is all over the country, and it's hard to prioritize where your funding's going to go when you've all of a sudden had to revert the way that you teach kids into an online methodology. Then money has to be diverted from other places in order to make that happen. And chances are one of the areas where it's having a reduced budgetary impact is on IT and cybersecurity. And also with all the students now logging in remotely from home, it increases the likelihood that schools are going to get hit by some kind of ransomware attack. Now, are the attackers brute force attacking their way into their networks and implanting malware on the computer servers? No. They are probably getting someone to receive an email that looks like it comes from a student that says, "Hey, I can't access my email. How do I help? Here's what my screen looks like." And it's a Word document or some kind of document that they get the person to open. The person opens that document. It's got malware attached to it, or it directs them to a website with malware. Ransomware is implanted on the system, and the school district is encrypted or shows up the next day. Their networks don't work. How do you protect this? Well, obviously, as I have said for 7 episodes, now going on 8, it's all about education. Train your folks on what to look for, how to be leery of particular attack attempts, and just be vigilant as to what's coming in on your email and those things that you're clicking on. It's really all you can do. The problem is if you haven't educated your folks on what that looks like and how to do it, then you can't expect them necessarily to recognize the problem when it comes in. So I think we're going to see, I'm going to predict this right now, as the school year goes forward, now that school districts are open everywhere, at least those that are open, you're going to see a lot more of this activity. You're going to see a lot more cyber attacks. You're going to see people's home information being compromised because of emails that come to them that appear to come to the school that give an attacker access to information on that. There's going to be a whole host of issues that occur because of remote learning and the inability for schools to prepare for it, educate their folks on what to look for, and to protect themselves against it. As we're talking about ransomware, we probably have crossed the cyber attack Rubicon here in that a ransomware attack against a hospital in Germany resulted in a death. Now, it wasn't a direct death in that the attack caused a system within the hospital to go down. But basically what happened was a university clinic in Dusseldorf got hit with ransomware. And as a result, one patient who required emergency medical treatment for a life-threatening condition had to be rerouted to an alternate facility 21 miles away because the hospital because they'd been hit by ransomware, couldn't access their computers, couldn't admit folks into the hospital. Now, if someone was sick, why you needed the computer to be able to allow someone into the hospital is a different story and a different conversation, perhaps for a different podcast. But in this case, they turned that patient away, sent the person to another hospital, and they died later because they were delayed by an hour in receiving the treatment they needed. And the death, at least according to this news article, could have been prevented had the treatment been provided sooner. This occurred on September 10th, and it completely crippled the clinic systems. The strange thing about this was the ransomware attack was not targeted at the hospital. It was targeted at a university in Dusseldorf. It just happened to go to the wrong email address. And as a result, the attackers found out that they had their ransomware had hit a hospital, and they actually provided the encryption back to the hospital so they could access all their information. However, likely, it really, you know, at the end of the day, the only person saved by this, or the only group saved by this, was the university that didn't get hit, because chances are, if the email had gone to them correctly, they would have got hit by ransomware. Wouldn't have had the same catastrophic impact that this particular ransomware attack had on hospitals. But it goes to show two other vulnerable sectors. When my previous story talked about public schools, well, now we have healthcare and universities that are highly targeted entities, simply because, like for hospitals, they have money to pay for the ransomware in most cases. They have insurance that can do that if the insurance allows it to be paid for ransomware. If they don't have the right, they don't have the right education, or they haven't done what they've needed to do, then the insurance may not necessarily pay for it. But those are two other entities that are highly vulnerable to cyber attacks, simply because it's hard to keep your personnel educated, because there's a lot of folks and there's a lot of information you have to pass out. And I think the world is still trying to come to grips with how exactly does that work. A couple other news stories, not really going into great detail, but the Department of Justice this week indicted 5 Chinese and 2 Iranian hackers for attacks against the United States. These are nice. This has occurred in the past, and I understand where the government's going with doing this. The two problems I see with it. Number one, these hackers are never going to come to the United States and plead guilty or not guilty and go to trial. They're basically going to stay in Iran. They're going to stay in China. They're not going to be extradited. And the indictments were largely for show. Now, granted, it does show a couple things, that the government's able to attribute cyber attacks to individuals. That's great. The problem is, because of the way they've done the indictments, they've had to probably give up information on how they found the information of these hackers, which allows the hackers to refine their processes and makes it harder for hackers in the future to be processed. So this is a funny tipping stone or area that it's hard for the government to figure out what's best to do. Do we indict international cyber actors? I say yes. I say you kind of have to do that, but it's you have to weigh what's the best situation for this. What is the impact? Chances are China and Iran are going to come back and say, well, this is not true. They did not do this. And the United States hacks us more than we hack them. It's going to be an ongoing international political battle. But just note that this occurred this week. It was interesting. It's good for the government to do those things, but I'm not sure the impact is really that fantastic. So my guest is retired FBI Special Agent Carrie Straub, who retired after 21 years from the Birmingham Division Huntsville Resident Agency and who currently works for a company in Huntsville named Analytics. Carrie, thanks for coming on.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. So give us a little history of how you got in the FBI, what you were doing before you were an agent. That's usually the question most FBI people ask other FBI people. What'd you do before the Bureau, and how'd you get in?
So I, after college, I had gone through the ROTC program, and I went into the Corps of Engineers and served almost 8 years in the Army Corps of Engineers, every place from Berlin, Germany to Fort Rucker, Alabama. I even, for some odd reason, they decided even to send me to Fort Polk, Louisiana. And anybody in the military will know Fort Polk is not the garden spot of the country. It's just a training area. And when I got assigned to it, they even said, I asked them, hey, that's not even on my list of places to go. And they said, well, we need you there. But I said, again, it's not on my list of places to go. So I finished up my career in the military at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And it was at the time where you either say, I'm going to stay in and make it a career of the Army, or get out and do something else. So I applied for the FBI, and after taking the test and doing the interviews and the fit test and the polygraph and the background, I finally got hired and went through Quantico. And once at Quantico, I put my name on lists of different places to go. And as you know, Darren, you put your list of places to go, and then the Bureau sends you where they need you, just like the military. And I had Birmingham on the list, and it was like number 10. And I initially wanted to go back up towards the Northeast where my family was from. And then, of course, they selected me to go down to Birmingham and Huntsville RA because they had me working on a case with some counterintelligence matters. And so they selected me and wound up in Huntsville for 21 years.
And you never left. You are the unofficial. When I came here as a supervisor for the CI squad, I was told that you need to meet Kerry because he's the mayor of Huntsville. But you're not really the mayor, but you're like the mayor.
Right, the honorary mayor. And and the thing is, Darren, barring what you see on television, as you know, the FBI, we don't come in there and say, hey, we're in charge. I mean, we, the FBI at the time, we're here to help, not hinder. We're here to, show. I mean, if we can provide assets to the locals, that's what I built my career on, is helping locals and doing stuff that need to get done.
Right. So let's talk about a couple of cases. You worked here in Huntsville before we did this interview. We talked about some cases to talk about. And this is a primarily cyber-focused podcast, but I know cyber wasn't your main area of expertise throughout most of your career. But it's interesting, I think, to take a different perspective, because every FBI agent, when they come in, has to do a bank robbery at some point. Bank robberies were the bread and butter of the FBI. So and public corruption is big in the South, obviously. In Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, public corruption is a big thing. So you talked about you had two of those cases there. So just give us a flavor of what those look like. The public corruption case was interesting because it sounded like this particular public corruption case could only have happened in Alabama. So talk a little bit about those cases.
Public corruption case. I was not the case agent, but I was one of the agents that worked the case. And it was a public corruption case where, believe it or not, in the South, we still have bootleggers. And the county in northern Alabama was a dry county. And the bootleggers, of course, would go into the next county over that was wet and pick up all the alcohol they needed and bring it back to the dry county to sell. Well, the FBI developed a source in the bootlegger and said, hey, we have some information that the people who are running elections are trading votes. And so we started investigating, and they were trading the votes. And how they did it was with absentee ballots. They would go in and go to somebody's house and say, hey, you don't have to go vote, in the primary or the general election. What we're going to do is I'll give you a fifth of whiskey or a case of beer, and we'll fill it all out for you, and you can even sign it, and then we'll take care of the rest. And so, and they were doing it all over the county. And we also looked at the absentee, and, it's funny when you have over 50% or more of the entire county voting absentee, and so 50% or more are outside the county for election day. So anyhow, the bottom line was there was a total of 11 indicted for voter fraud, and two of the indictments were dropped, and then you had nine that were actually sentenced.
Well, that's interesting because now, of course, obviously the mail-in voting is a big thing for this particular election. This is not a political show. But it's ironic that particular case, in order to get to pack the ballot, you just needed little alcohol, and you're off the races. It doesn't bode well for this coming election, but we probably won't spend a lot of time talking that here.
No, and it's not. It's just funny, though, too, is the the candidates that were running, a lot of them were running unopposed. So they didn't even have to do that. It didn't matter.
Well, that's Alabama. So, I mean, I love Alabama. Don't get me wrong, but it's just funny that the
no, no, like
that
absolutely.
So your bank robbery case. Right. Talk about the bank robbery case. I know I did one bank robbery case in Charlotte. It was I showed up for a bank robbery. You know, in the past, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, bank robberies were the majority of what the Bureau worked. When I got in early 2000, I think I went to one because at that point we were called in as a courtesy. We didn't really run them per se. But so talk about your bank robbery experience.
So we had a bank robbery in Huntsville, and it was an unsolved where, you know, the guy wore a baseball hat, typical baseball hat, sunglasses, had a mustache, and presented a note, and he got X amount of dollars, and then we had no other information on him. So, and that bank robbery was about a year or so old. And then I got a bank robbery where same type of description, but, you know, the cameras in banks are not necessarily the best at times. Back in 2000, they were still on videotape. And so, and that's if they changed the tapes out and they weren't overwritten. So anyhow, same type of description, baseball hat, sunglasses, and mustache. And then we got a lead from a bank robbery out west, and it had a partial license plate. And so I started running the license plate because it sounded something similar to ours. So I ran the license plate, and I came up with a fellow by the name of Harvey Miller. And I start doing, you know, the proverbial checks, and found out the residence and the road that he lived on when he was in Huntsville. And guess the name of the road, Darren, that he lived in Huntsville.
Miller Road.
No. Robin Hood Lane.
Oh, there you go. Even better.
So he was on Robin Hood Lane, but he had not been there for a while. And finally, I was able to catch him. He, like other folks too, he ran home to mom up in the Northeast, and we were able to catch him. And he turned around. He had robbed a total of 13 banks across the country. And it was always a note job. And, you know, he didn't get a whole heck of a lot of money, but, you know, it just shows again. And it showed to me about the FBI is, we, even though we have a local bank robbery, sometimes we can reach out to other parts of the country and have those connections that, you know, we can put the puzzle together and finally find who did the bank robbery.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the advantages to the FBI is the cross jurisdictional capabilities. To you have something that happens in Huntsville, and you can very quickly transition to somewhere in the Northeast to find who you're looking for and get their hands on them.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the FBI's outreach program. As you mentioned at the top of the interview, you came into the Bureau as wanting to help individuals. I think the FBI's outreach program is designed exactly to do that, to help companies understand what the threats are that are targeting them. It's now currently called the Office of Private Sector Program, but that wasn't always the name. How did you get involved with it, and what was your role with it? What'd you like about it? Talk a little bit about what the outreach program was when you started.
Sure. So again, like you said, being the honorary mayor of Huntsville, we had one of the agents in our office retire, and the position needed to be filled. And I was duly anointed to go fill that position, which, you know, at the time I thought, let's see how that all, but I mean, it was a perfect fit for me because it was a different sector. You know, in the FBI initially we're with criminals, and this is an outreach, and it's showing to the private sector that the FBI is concerned about their intellectual property, about what they're doing, about their technologies that they're doing. And especially here in Huntsville, you know, we have over 400 clear defense contracting businesses in the greater Huntsville area. I mean, so it's just ripe. And I've told folks all the time that if they don't think they're a target, they are. And one of the best examples I can give you on that is the there was a person working missiles here in Huntsville, and he turns around and gets a LinkedIn request from a person and says, "Oh, I went to the same university as you, give or take a year, and in the same fraternity as you, give or take a year, and working on the same missile program as you." And so the guy said, "Well, I guess I know," and he linked with him. So fast forward a couple weeks later, the guy who got the LinkedIn request gets another request from this guy. Says, "Hey, I'm trying to get the program management office, you know, to send me the tech manual for this particular missile." And he says, "Now that doesn't sound right." So he did report this to Defense Security Services. Now it's, I think, Defense Counterintelligence Security Agency. And they reached out, and we did some checking, and guess where that LinkedIn profile of that guy requesting the tech manuals was set up in? Guess what country, I guess, is the bigger thing.
I guess China, the top of my China close. Or Iran?
It was Iran. It was Iran. And so I used that story when I talked to companies to say, "Hey, listen, you are a target. And you need to know that they want our stuff." And the big thing is companies, and especially around our, you know, all the engineers and the folks working on the programs understand that that's their business, but they don't understand, you know, hey, you need to protect your information, because if that information goes, so does your job.
Right. And how many companies do you think you talked to during your time in that role? There's 400 clear defense contractors here. How many of those do you think you reached during that time?
I would say at least 200, if not more. I mean, and I would try to go to all the conferences that we would hold within our community, and poke my head at some. And it's kind of funny. You know, if I talk to a company, sometimes they've called back and said, "Is this guy really with the FBI?" And, you know, it's just trying, you know, trying to get the word out, because, you know, the FBI, I mean, we are concerned about protecting our secrets, because if they get out, you know, we lose our foothold.
Sure. And I was always surprised, because when I got here, so you were primarily giving counterintelligence presentations at the time. And I think we kind of transitioned into adding some cyber bits into that, because those two areas, cyber and counterintelligence, have really pretty much blended together and become interchangeable in that respect. But I was always surprised at companies, when I spoke to them, how surprised they were that the information we were talking about, and you've said it here, is that, you know, they just didn't believe that they could be a target. Did you find that to be more of the norm, or did you find most companies kind of knew it, they just needed a refresher?
I think so. They knew it, but they kind of put that on the back burner. I mean, it's almost like that InfoSec training that we did in the government, where we had to, you know, we go through and click, click, click. Okay. Yeah. Don't click on the link. Don't do this. Don't do that. And all right, let me get back to my work. And they needed, I think, real world stories of what's going on, what's happened. And one of the examples I can give you is, I was talking to a company in Birmingham, and they did business over in China. And And it was actually one of the owners of the company was over traveling in China. And while he was there, he had, you know, set up his reservation at the hotel, and he gets to the hotel and they said, "Hey, we're all out of rooms, but for you, because you've come here numerous times, we're going to give you an apartment. And he says, oh, okay. But it has no Wi-Fi. He's like, okay. But here's a thumb drive you can plug in to get the Wi-Fi access to our system. And he's like, And he didn't plug it in, thank goodness. And when he was checking out, the person of the hotel then asked, well, how was everything? Oh, it was good. Hey, how was the Wi-Fi? He said, I didn't use it. And they got kind of perturbed with him that he didn't use the Wi-Fi. So, and, you know, and it was because of that outreach that I got that story, because had I not gone to talk to that company, we would have never known anything. And you know, and the proverbial trade craft of, you know, the Chinese, you know, they're going to do anything to try to get our stuff. And if that means I'm going to give a thumb drive to a engineer so he can plug it in, all power to him.
Did he bring the thumb drive back with him?
I did not get any thumb drive from him.
That's too bad. That would have been good intelligence. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That one. Oh, well.
Absolutely.
So for companies that have never had the FBI come out and talk to them, what would you say to them? And how did you weave education into your presentation? So did you make them all? Did you create the presentation yourself? Did you use canned stuff? Did you have movies? How did that all work out?
So the program office from the FBI had done some very good videos, in my opinion, just to kind of show this is what happens. And so I would show a video, and then I would also ask, you know, the way I did my presentations, that I'd ask questions, and we actually had some, you know, the proverbial little trinkets, you know, whether it's a FBI pen or even an FBI mug, I gave those away. You know, I'd ask them questions, and then, you know, if they got it right, they get an FBI pen. I did remove the microphone from them.
That's good.
But not
the video camera though, right? You left the video camera in.
No. So, but I kind of, because I think we nowadays PowerPoint to death, in my opinion. And so I did not want to give them a PowerPoint presentation as much as I wanted to give them, like I said, the stories, you know, some real world. And so for me, I was always trying to read up on the current, you know, who's been arrested lately. And as you pointed out to me last week, you know, was, you know, the, you know, a couple of the Chinese, you know, professors stealing stuff and throwing hard drives out in the garbage to be picked up later. So those are the type of stories I would share with them to show, hey, listen, you know, all right, you know this cybersecurity stuff, but this is stuff you need to know about. This is what they're doing, and they're doing it here locally. And it was the same thing, Darren, with the outreach, because we have foreign visitors coming to our area all the time. And I would tell folks, just be cognizant of who and what they are. And once I told one of the companies, they said, well, you know, we had a foreign visitor come, and they did all the right things, you know, gave us their name, gave us, you know, date of birth, hair color, blue eye, whatever. But when they showed up, they were 30 years older and bald. And so I asked them, did you let them in? No. I made them sit out in the lobby. They're not going to come in here. I don't know who they are. I said, and that's the right thing to do. And I think one of the other things is that the executive office needs to hear stuff from the FBI and be aware and cognizant instead of always looking at the bottom dollar of their company. I mean, granted, I know they have to. I mean, I get all that bottom dollar thing. But they need to be aware of security is just as important, because, I mean, S target, you know, what happens when they get a breach, or, you know, other companies, and then what happens to them? They're no longer around.
Yeah, I think that was always kind of the disappointing thing when I would go out and do presentations at companies is they had all the employees there. It was mandatory for the employees to go listen, but the executives were rarely there. Every once in a while, you might get one C-level person, but the CEO was never there. They never had the you never talked to the board of directors. It was always the frontline employee, which is it's good for them to have that knowledge. But like you said, if the C-suite doesn't have that information and doesn't push down the leadership on how they're going to deal with the cyber threats, they're just basically asking to be hit at some point.
Well, and I don't remember if I ever told you this. I mean, I went out to one of the companies and actually talked to the board of directors and the president of the company and just saying, hey, you need to protect your stuff and you need to be concerned about it. And he says, I guess we've got to figure out what our crown jewels are. And I'm like, if you don't know as the board of directors and the president what your crown jewels are, you need to do some more internal looking before you decide, you know.
Due to some technical difficulties, my conversation with Kerry got disconnected, hence the abrupt conclusion there. But I want to thank Kerry for coming on to talk a little about his career in the FBI's outreach program. If you'd like someone from the FBI's Office of Private Sector to come speak to your company or your local social group on the threats that face your community, contact your nearest FBI office and they can arrange to make that happen for you. As always, I want to thank you for listening. If you have any questions you'd like me to address on a future podcast or topics that you'd like to hear, please email me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, at The Cyber Guy. Cyber is spelled C-Y-B-U-R. And as you progress through your week, make sure you understand the cyber threats that are attacking you, assess your overall cyber risk, and proceed wisely. Have a good week.